The Sky News Centre at 6. It's understood around 35 British cruise ship passengers stranded in Japan because of the coronavirus outbreak are preparing to fly home. Anyone showing symptoms won't be allowed on the flight, though, organised by the British government, and those who do return face another 2 weeks in isolation. But Dr. Kate Bunyan, a former medical director at Carnival Cruises, says it is necessary.
The biggest challenge that we're facing with this is how many people have very mild symptoms, or indeed no symptoms at all, and yet they're testing positive. So I think while we're trying very hard to contain the spread of this infection across the globe, quarantine is playing an important part in that.
A man stabbed at a mosque as he led prayers says he forgives his alleged attacker. Rafat Maglad says, as a Muslim, he does not hold any hatred in his heart. Prince Charles has been meeting people in flood-hit Pontypridd in South Wales following Storm Dennis. Meanwhile, actor Michael Sheen set up an online fundraising page to help those affected. The Welsh star says a member of his family was forced to leave their home.
She just left with her two dogs in her pyjamas in a boat and had to leave all her possessions. She couldn't go back because of health risks around sewage. So she doesn't know whether any of her stuff will survive or not, when she'll be able to go back home. And it really hit home, you know. So I thought, well, I want to do something to help.
In other news this evening, former England rugby star Danny Cipriani says he believes Caroline Flack was killed by embarrassment and shame. He posted an emotional video on Instagram in tribute to the late TV presenter who he previously dated. The price of first and second class stamps will increase from next month. Royal Mail says a first class will jump 6 pence and a second will rise by 4 pence on the 23rd of March. And this evening's Scottish Premiership match between St Mirren and Hearts has been postponed due to this bad weather. The pitch in Paisley failed an inspection due to it being waterlogged. That's the latest. I'm Daryl Jackson.
It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, 9 shot dead by a far-right extremist in Hanau, Germany, who then shoots his mother and himself dead, apparently. And just as a new US ambassador to Germany, Richard Greenall, he's also the US Director of National Intelligence, arrives to take a job in Berlin. And if you've not heard from this show's favourite Democratic nomination candidate, Tulsi Gabbard, that's just what the oligarchy want. We certainly will tonight, as she analyses the problems with the Democratic Party and the whole nomination process. And have you got £4.6 million spare to start a political party? The Thai opposition party Future Forward's founder did, but it's just been forced to close today amid claims it's part of a famous Western elite cult to take over the country. And as a real treat, before I take a few weeks off, a rogue insider reminds us all how terrible our mass media are with 10 minutes of straight talking on the finance of politics, which I think you'll agree is worth a year of the financial media's mendacious babble. And what is the UK exporting to the USA? Oxitec is high tech, all right, but is it ethical? Extracts from two documentaries tonight. The first about AIDS, the first so-called virus ever found to target the T-cells of our immune system. From 2011, the documentaries AIDS, the greatest medical fraud in history, then up to 2019, and the winner of the Sundance Film Festival's Best Documentary Award. The documentary is called Cold Case Hammarskjöld, which we mentioned last week, exposing the secret far-right private army, Saimar, who assassinated the UN Secretary-General in 1961, then went on to inject black people, they say, in Mozambique with AIDS, and murder young biologist Dagmar Fayle, who tried to expose these tactics to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. So that's all in the second hour, if we can fit it all in, after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So tonight, lows of 9 Celsius, some light rain. This weekend, highs of 11, strong winds and rain tomorrow, but light rain on Sunday. Next week, highs around 11, lots of showers, windy at times too. Next weekend, 2nd and 3rd of March, highs still around 11 Celsius, sunshine and showers, but more sunny next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is the former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Hi, George, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony and Martin.
Could you give us your take on the two major developments that have been going on in the city recently? There's a lot of discussion about them both. One is the Western Harbour and the other is the Temple Island. You can choose which one you start with. Which one would you like to start?
Well, let's start with Western Harbour. I think Western Harbour is indicative of what's going on in the mayoral office at the moment. He's wildly... issuing edicts about various schemes in Bristol, whether they be tunnels or massive schemes or high buildings. And the Western Harbour one is one that just hasn't been thought through like all the others. And it involves a big highway scheme. The highway scheme, I think, is completely unnecessary, is a total distraction. He claims it's necessary in order to build 2,500 new homes. There are far better places to build 2,500 new homes. You can build new homes there, but nothing like that number. And it's not being thought through in a comprehensive fashion. We had this road scheme, and then that ran into trouble, so it suddenly turned into a housing scheme. What we really should be looking at is how in this city that is polluted, that is a wonderful city that could do with less traffic rather than more, a city that is down at sea level for much of it in a time when sea levels are rising and floods becoming more prevalent, we should be looking at this in a broader fashion. We should be looking at how we temper the flood threat at Avonmouth, how we then use that also to divert the traffic away from Cumberland Basin, because the two can work together at Avonmouth, and how we turn the Cumberland Basin into a local part of the highway network rather than into a national part, which is its problem.
Well, it would be lovely to have Marvin Rees along here discussing some of this, the mayor, with you, but he just hasn't replied to any of my requests for to be interviewed for the last 4 years, although I did try again this week. It does seem like there's a bit of a mental block there, that there isn't. I mean, have you actually managed to discuss this? Is there a forum that you can engage with this whole process, or is it just you feel it's just being decided from on high?
Well, not with Marvin. So don't take it personally, Tony. Marvin is avoiding most communication. The times I've seen Marvin recently, and every single time he says it, and of course to attack it makes me sound rotten, is every time he said, oh, I've got to go and collect the kids, I've got to go and do something with the kids. It's become his standard excuse in order not to debate anything. He turned up to Holy Trinity Church. I couldn't be there when there was 200 people to discuss this whole issue of Cumberland Basin and the Western Harbour and its impact on the views of the gorge and the bridge and Clifton and its impact on the traffic and the air pollution. He gave a spiel, said he had to go off and look after the kids, and therefore there was no real questioning.
What's the problem with that? I mean, he's got young kids to look after. He's got to look after them as well, hasn't he? As well as do the civic duties.
Of course he has. But it's really important that the mayor puts the city... You don't stand for mayor unless you've got time to do the job. You don't stand for mayor in order to use excuses like that in order to get away from, to get out of answering questions. If he'd done it once, I'd believe it. If he'd done it three times, I'd believe it. He's done it hundreds and hundreds of times. It's become a refrain.
That's got to be an exaggeration, George.
No, it isn't an exaggeration. It's become a refrain that is really boring people. I'm probably the first person to raise it because it is such a sensitive issue.
Okay, so
but it is clear that Marvin avoids questioning.
Okay, so
he believes he's right. He's got God in his side, and he avoids the difficult questions.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I mean, if what is the thinking? Do you think behind this development proposal, if it isn't going to be as good as you think you're saying for the city, why is it even being proposed?
I think you've got to bear in mind, Marvin doesn't have. He doesn't have experience of running a city. He doesn't have experience of development. It's not the world he comes from. He takes advice from others. You need experience in a situation in a post like that to be able to ask the right questions. So I think he's being led by the nose, by the people who run his office, by the people who have been in there on a temporary basis advising him on development. They see this as a big opportunity because they don't have an investment, a social, a cultural investment in Bristol. To them, it's just another place.
Oh, you sound a bit like President Eisenhower when he left office. He was saying, God help anyone that takes over this country that doesn't know the tricks the military will play on you like, I mean, almost like the developers. I mean, they are, I imagine, quite an organised lobby, and you have to know how to deal with them.
No, I don't say all the developers are wrong. I'm saying some of the advisors on development are. I think, this is a difficult one. There are some good developers. Some of the developers are terrible. Some of the house builders are awful. The big house builders that are only interested in banging out units and flogging them are not ever going to produce decent stuff. There's a house builder that's proposing a dreadful scheme down by near Cumberland Basin at the moment on the old railway sidings that cuts across the allotments and the cycle path, the Jubilee Way. It's the most dreadful scheme designed by architects who clearly don't know the city, who have absolutely no sensitivity to the place. But to that particular developer, Galliford Try, it is just more money. It's not about making a decent place. And the problem with planning in Bristol at the moment, and Western Harbour is just evidence of that, the problem with planning in Bristol at the moment, it's governed by numbers, not by quality of place. And if you just chase numbers and you do anything in order to achieve those numbers, you build the wrong sort of thing that is not sustainable, that people do not want, and therefore will only last for 20 or 30 years. And we've seen that in the past. People have demolished, only today they're demolishing, they're demolishing buildings in other cities that were put up in the 70s and 80s because they were inappropriate.
Do you think the same will be happening here in a couple of decades' time?
Well, you'd hope so. The problem is that then you'd hope so if it's wrong.
These things are supposed to last 200 years.
Absolutely. Therefore, it's unthinkable to me that it gets built in the way that is currently envisaged and that we do get something decent. I mean, if you go down to Wapping Wharf at the moment and see where the containers are, the jail ferry steps around there, that scale is good. It's a people-based development. It's not just big architecture. It's proper urban placemaking. And it's got interesting things. All the businesses there are independent. And if you can create that sort of place, and I believe that can be done, then it will last. But if you create just a standard blocky development, which we're seeing far too much of in Bristol, you know, I've just cycled across Castle Park and they're putting up this huge, great 24, 25, 26 story building. And all they've got up at the moment is the core, the lift shaft.
That's the old ambulance.
On the ambulance station side. And you look back from Old Market, well, what's that do? It totally destroys the ambience of a very historic place. And that is seen from all over the place. I see it from Brandon Hill. You see it from the city centre. And are we trying to be Birmingham? Why can't we build on the character that is Bristol? It seems that there is an obsession from the mayor and his office to turn us into something else.
Well, he wants to see cranes on the horizon. That's what he says. This is a great sign. It's a sign the city's moving forward.
Well, I don't disagree with him about cranes. I like to see cranes, but I like to see cranes building the right sort of thing. I like to see cranes building streets, squares, places, meeting places. Development should be absolutely about the people and the communities and the neighbourhoods and the activity. That's what I've tried to create around the tobacco factory and North Street and that part of South Bristol. And it's a lesson that people learn from. And you only have to go to good European cities. You don't go to Bordeaux and find them doing the same thing, because Bordeaux, our twin city, you don't go to Porto in Portugal and find them doing the same thing, also our twin city, because they value the character, the culture, the social activity that makes their place, the history. And I would just like to see a mayor that has that sensitivity and passion about the place.
Look, it's the speculators, it's the developers that actually apply for this planning permission. How much say does the mayor really have?
The mayor just sets the scene. The mayor is not giving planning permission. But what the mayor has done is managed to change the local plan so that the direction to planners is one that encourages high buildings. I know down in North Street in Bedminster, a developer who wanted to build 4 and 5 stories, and so he went in with a 6-story application in order to be knocked down a story, because he thought that's bound to happen. Instead, the conservation officer — this is an area where it's all 2 and 3 stories — the conservation officer said, oh no, I think the mayor would like it higher than that. The mayor has no planning position at all in terms of planning control.
You're saying he's sort of steering the officers?
But they are taking their messaging from the mayor's office.
Okay, well, you're talking about things...
And they've gone up to... And now he encouraged them to go up to 9 stories, not down to the 5 that developer was expecting. Well, that developer is obviously rubbing their hands in glee.
Well, let's talk for a minute about things that last a bit longer than 20 years or so before someone gets fed up with them and they get demolished. And that is the cut, because along Cumberland Road there's been this enormous collapse. Are you glad, George, that didn't happen on your watch, the sliding down of the Cumberland Road into the River Avon?
Well, to a certain extent it did happen on my watch. I knew, and we all knew, that there was a structural problem there. I thought it was going to be dealt with in 2016. I left office in May 2016. I thought by the end of the year...
So you left that one to Marvin. Thanks, I'm sure he's saying.
Well, of course, it happened... I think the reports were in 2015 and 2016 on the state of the chocolate path, and it was very concerning. And I think we would have dealt with that undoubtedly by now. It was on the to-do list. So I was pretty shocked to find that over four years on, nothing had happened. What is really stupid about it, we've invested all this money in the metro bus route that went along Cumberland Road, and now I think is going along Cumberland Road again, because I've just cycled over it, and there's traffic going up and down Cumberland Road. I've been away for a few days. So it seems to have reopened again. But putting that absolutely vital public transport route at risk by neglecting the structure of the side of the road, which is on the edge of the new cut, seems negligent to me.
So it needn't have happened.
Oh, it certainly needn't have happened. We all knew the structural condition. It is extraordinary that nothing was done to prop it up.
Well, we seem to be
in
living
over 4 years.
I mean, this is probably not the mayor's, Marvin Rees's, fault, but we seem to be living in a world now of massive local government cuts where things like that are just left to happen. So, what we used to call years ago fire brigade management: wait for a disaster and then go and sort it out.
No, there is money to do those sort of things. And incidentally, I know there was a lot of political mischief about the money I didn't leave in the council. I left the council with a lot of capital and in a very good financial state. There is plenty of money to deal with infrastructure issues like that.
Well, the Bundred report said something completely opposite, actually, George, didn't it? It said the opposite. It said
Well, I think it's the information you're given, and it's the questions you're asked that leads to that. The fact is that they were looking at a small section. They weren't looking at the bigger picture. The city is far better off from the purchases, from the property purchases we made around Temple Meads by tens of millions of pounds. So the amount of money that was needed to deal with that would easily have been found and should have been found, certainly to do the emergency work that would have prevented that happening.
What about flood defences? Because we've seen a massive... Actually, I was chatting to a contact of mine, Greg Lance Watkins, who lives in Chepstow, about something completely different. And I suddenly thought, well, he's in Chepstow. This is where the Severn and the Wye meet. And it's probably an interesting place to ask him about what he thinks of the flood defences there. And he said, well, nobody here will buy a house which is very low down. They're very cheap, but you know you're going to get flooded every 15 years or so. There's some horrendous floods around here. What are your thoughts about the flood defences and also the bigger issue, which is potentially climate change?
Well, I think climate change is the very biggest issue that we're faced with. I think it's not just an economic issue or an environmental issue. I think it's a social issue, I think. And the poorest people and the poorest countries will suffer most. And so climate change is something that I feel embarrassed about as an older person when I talk to young people. They are in despair about it. I try to encourage them to do something about it, because I think it's necessary, and I couldn't live with myself unless I did everything I could for them, because, you know, if I'm lucky, I've got another 20 years, they've got another 80, 90 years, some of them, and it's really important that we deal with it. Flooding is one of the consequences of climate change. It's going to become more frequent. I feel extremely sorry for those people who have had their houses flooded. It's a terrible experience for them. It's an awful financial blow for householders and businesses who find themselves in that situation. And it's enough to make you cry when you see, you know, pubs that are having to close and places that are really destroyed by the threat of flooding, if not by by flooding itself. So I think it's far more important to invest billions into flood defences and to admit that some areas will just have to be abandoned. You know, we should concentrate on the high population areas in terms of flood defences. The centre of Bristol is at big risk. And when there's a coincidence of high tide and some of the weather that we've been having, water flowing down the rivers, there is the real probability of some city centre flooding, and that will affect thousands of homes. So it's a no-brainer to me that it would be much more credible, much more important in every respect to invest those billions that invest in having slightly faster trains going up and down the country, because we can produce faster trains on the existing network. We can make them more comfortable. But to me, the priority, and I'm all for trains, I'm all for getting people moving by public transport between our cities rather than flying, moving by rail rather than flying or driving. But the priority at the moment must be, over the next 10 years, if we're not to suffer over the next 50 and 100 years, to deal with the flood defences. And Bristol is in a very, very strong position.
I mean, the £100 billion being spent on HS2, I think, is pretty indefensible when you look at the so-called benefits. And also, of course, most ordinary people won't be able to afford to go on this train. It's going to be business users on expenses that will be using it. What about this whole plan, which has been mooted recently? It's almost as a sop to those that have been successfully criticising HS2 to, say, reopen old rail lines, because that really was in the 1960s, an enormous amount were closed. I mean, there are all sorts of theories, conspiracy theories, what you might even say, about why Beeching closed the railways. Probably the most, I think, credible is that the Americans wanted us to open up a massive domestic market for oil because North Sea oil was coming on stream. They didn't want the world oil price going down because, you know, they were all bought and sold in dollars. So there was a pressure to get the British to get motorways, get cars. You know, the Germans had the autobahns, the Americans had their freeways, and it's time for the Brits to get cars. But what do you make of that as a possibility? Because the there are a lot of old lines out there. There's actually apparently one we'll hear about in a minute up to Birmingham, which is an old high-speed line which has been closed since the 1960s.
Yes, I remember the Beeching cuts very vividly. I remember thinking myself as a teenager then that it was nuts. And very sad. It wasn't just a nostalgic thing. I thought, well, why on earth are we encouraging more people to drive? And then it was relatively easy to drive around, and driving, cars were a privilege. Now they've become a necessity, and if not a physical necessity, a social one. And I think you're absolutely right. We should look at reversing a lot of the Beeching cuts. I mean, one of the issues, one of the only good thing that came out of the cutting of some of those lines is they've turned into very busy routes for walking and cycling, like the Bristol and Bath cycle route, which takes more cyclists and walkers than it ever did passengers. So it's not that easy to reverse those, but I think an investment in the regional railways would be much more effective and impact beneficially on more people.
I mean, if it costs
than this 100 million HS2, which actually doesn't go that far.
If it costs people less than it costs to drive, people would use a train. I've got no doubt about that. One of the ways to stop people driving around is to impose a diesel ban. What do you make of this proposal?
Well, I think that's a bit of a token, really. I think I would be much more radical than that. People would probably be delighted that I wasn't re-elected when I say that I would take cars, except for the essential ones, those for disabled and business, taxis and buses, I would take them completely out of quite a large area of the centre of the city.
That's what's now being proposed, isn't it?
Not just diesel, but I would take cars, cars. Private cars have become less and less necessary. They will become less and less necessary. Parking is a nightmare. I made it more of a nightmare deliberately because I felt that it was wrong that our residential areas were used as commuter car parks, which encouraged more people to drive into the city who could come by other means. And that has been really effective, and people have ask me for more.
But Marvin has
taken
a leaf out of your book here, maybe, because now he's committed to pedestrianising the whole of the old city, hasn't he?
Well, I've heard it, and thank bully for him. I hope he does it, but I think it's more than just the old city. I think there is a large area of the city that you could walk across in 15 minutes and cycle across in 5 that... it probably takes you just as long to drive across, okay. And therefore why
I've just
have cars
in. Brought the map up here on the screen, and it looks as if it's the whole from Castle Park to Stokes Croft, including the Bear Pit, whole Bear Pit area. They're going to try and pedestrianise all that.
Great, and let's see it happen, because I've not yet seen any tangible improvements.
Well, this, I think, is part of Marvin's election campaign. Do you think he'll get in again?
Yes. I think it's almost inevitable Marvin will get in again because, the Labour Party has the money, the troops, the information being really important. That's something I didn't have. And unless Unless everybody who is despairing of the politicisation, the extreme politicisation of the mayoral post, which I think should be more independent, whether it's a party mayor or not, I think it should be more independent, like it is in Manchester and Birmingham. And unless people rally around a single candidate, a single opposition candidate, then Labour will win. Marvin will ride on that Labour ticket. And in Bristol, there is a natural, whether it's an overall majority, but it's certainly natural biggest vote. So the only hope is for people to rally behind a single credible candidate to beat
him. Don't you think Marvin might suffer from Jeremy Corbyn falling on his face in the recent general election?
I don't actually, because Bristol has, you know, out of that general election, you know, in a way I quite like it. Bristol is an island in a sea of blue, and, you know, it's a red island in a sea of blue on the political map. Yeah, in a way I celebrate that. But it is a shame that that maintains a mayoral regime that I think is bad for Bristol in the way it's going.
So you don't like the whole idea of the mayor system, even though you were mayor yourself?
I don't like the idea of a mayor for Bristol. I never did. I stood as a mayor for Bristol simply because there wasn't an alternative. I've always promoted a mayor for the metro region, like Manchester and Birmingham have, and some of the other northern city regions. Andy Burnham and Andy Street, everybody's heard of. They're strong mayors. One's Labour, one's Tory, but they put their city region first. And they are listened to by Westminster. They're listened to by government. And Andy Burnham is even listened to by Tory ministers. And I've heard them having respect for what's happening there. We're losing out because we've got a weak metro mayor and we've got an obstinate city mayor. And they both weaken each other's position. Government is not really prepared to deal with either of them. Neither of them are making the sort of demands we should be making of government for this city. And
Which are?
Well, that are about the environment in particular. I think that that is something that touches everybody. Health is, in a way, the most important thing, that our children, our old people can walk around and breathe fresh air and all those sort of things. We need a very strong transport strategy that is one that is based on reducing pollution. We desperately need to deal with the homelessness situation, which isn't just a tight city issue. It's a city region. It's a regional issue. They're simply not working together to deal with these issues. Well, so you can't deal with the environment on the basis of a tight urban boundary. You have to look at city and country.
Well,
you have
to look at the two. The buses. I mean, everyone is always complaining that they're far too expensive. And now we're hearing that First West of England is launching a consultation to axe another bus route. It's essentially the managers of First Bus are looking at this and saying, well, actually, the margins just aren't big enough on this route, and they may even be losing money. Whereas in the old days, of course, you'd get the high density routes would be subsidising the other ones. So how to deal with this? Is any way to deal with it? Given
yes, there
that we've
is.
Got this yeah. privatised
yeah.
system?
Yeah, no, you need a stronger contract between city and bus company. We have a shambles of a bus system. Not, and this isn't criticism of First Bus, it's a criticism of the system that is one where basically it's the routes that pay get the attention, and it shouldn't be thus.
I mean, the temptation,
you know, whether you have nationalised buses or localised buses, or whether you have privatised buses, you're absolutely right. We should have a balanced system where the profitable routes subsidise the unprofitable routes, and otherwise you just leave people stranded.
The temptation here is, if you're a bus company manager, Martin Summers, you can come in on this one, is that you look at all the routes. This one's making X amount of money. The high profit margin ones stay. The low profit margin ones, or the ones that aren't making hardly any money at all, will go. How are we going to fix it?
Well, I mean, one of the things to do is not mess it up in the first place. I remember when the buses were privatised, and you probably remember this as well, Tony, where we had all of these companies came into the market, and then they carried out predatory tactics to push each other out. So you'd be waiting at a bus stop, and a bus would pull up. That one, you know, and of course, eventually, what came out of that is Stagecoach and First Bus began to dominate across because they would basically run buses at a loss until they'd driven out of all the competition, which is what you'd expect from reading your economics textbook. Which is why, of course, Transport for London has not been privatised because they knew very well that if it did, it would lead to that transport chaos. But of course, if you do stupid stuff and then you don't go back and say, this is stupid, we shouldn't have done it. And of course, that's what happened. We had 13 years of Labour government and they didn't do anything about it. They carried on allowing this shambles of a system to continue. And of course, over time, it gradually creates all of the problems, including transport problems, problems with cars. There's no overall planning conception in this country. We believe in the free market, which is actually basically allowing monopolies to extract rent.
Well, we've heard all about Western Harbour. We're going to be hearing about Temple Island, which I like to call Templar Island, just because I'm like that. But after we've heard from a chap who was here in Bristol, quite a quiet guy, but has some fascinating things to say. Last Saturday, his name's Joe Bezick from the New Economics Foundation, and he was speaking about land and land justice, as you'd expect at the Land Justice Network's conference last Saturday.
I think what we're trying to fight here is what's called the financialisation of land. So that's the treatment of land as a financial asset. Land can have many different roles in society, has and does, but its primary role in many societies nowadays is as a financial asset. What does that mean? It means that the value of all the land in the UK at the moment is £5 trillion, more than half of the net worth of the country. So if you added up everything of financial value in the UK, then more than half of it will be land. So land is so expensive, and what that means is that that price places a barrier on socially useful uses of that land. We're obviously talking about housing, and so what that means in terms of housing is that the cost of building a house, you look at a house, we call it a house, we don't call it a land. But it's not the bricks and it's not the construction which costs the majority of the money. Up to 70% of the cost of a house is the cost of the land. So at the New Economics Foundation, NEF, we did some research last year and looked at the role that land prices play in like delivering social rented housing, the only type of housing that's affordable for people on the lowest incomes. And found that in the councils in the areas of the country with the highest land prices between 2010 and 2015, the amount of social housing we were building had dropped by 80%. Whereas in the rest of the country with less high land prices, the amount of social housing we were building would drop by 20%. So it's clear that the price of land, the financialization of land that we've allowed to happen over the last 4 or 5 decades. Is the driver of the housing crisis.
Well, it's been, I mean, Henry George pointed this out in the 19th century and into the 20th century. Basically, land is a positional good, and those who dominate it are able to extract rents from the rest of the society. So, you know, when you build something like a new tube station, for example, the value of the land around that grows up, and people who own that land make a windfall profit, even though in actual fact they've done nothing. And of course, this was well understood, and this is what led to ideas of things like land nationalisation and so on. And our New Economics Foundation will be familiar with these kind of ideas. But of course, there's been a land-owning class and a property-developing class in this country, which has dominated the politics of the country for hundreds of years, and they still do. And that's why we get all these misallocation of resources.
George, in the Bristol Post, we've got headline, opposition councillors launch a bid to block the planned Temple Island redevelopment. A Labour group responds by saying it's an attempt to chase headlines, stall new jobs for Bristolians and delay much-needed new affordable housing. The Lib Dem and Conservative members say the decision by Bristol City Council's Cabinet to enter a strategic partnership with Legal & General to build 500 homes, a 350-room hotel, a conference centre and office blocks on the land formerly earmarked for an arena has broken the authority's own rules.
I mean, it transpires there is absolutely no commitment in this agreement to build one home. So it's a very dodgy deal. And how they think they get away with, they probably do, but how do they get away with no competition, just dealing with one large financial corporation, Legal & General, and doing an under-the-table deal that doesn't even have a commitment to build any homes, that results in the city having to spend another $32 million on top of the $30 million or so it's already committed to that site, that means that they have to underwrite Legal & General's the rent to Legal & General on the commercial development. It's the lousiest deal that any local authority has ever done, in my eyes. So I should think it should be called in. And it's typical to try and say that this will damage jobs and delay housing. Nothing of the sort. What it will do, hopefully, is get people to sit up and realise the crummy deal that the mayor is trying to do with Legal & General.
Oh, it's worth saying that the only reason we know that there's no commitment for housing was because of the incompetence whoever published the PDF file on the internet of the deal with Legal & General, because the blacking out over the words, the redactions, were visible to some smart people that found you could highlight them, cut and paste them into a Word document, and you could see everything that was underneath. But this is going to be, it looks like on the artist's diagram, 12 great big tower blocks. In fact, I don't think you could fit any more tower blocks onto Temple
Island. It's
horrible.
It's horrible. Yeah.
But what they would say, though, of course, is, well, at least the Bridge to Nowhere is now going somewhere, even if it is to 12 tower blocks.
Yeah, but that's sort of read that the bridge should go to somewhere decent. You know, it should go to somewhere that is part of Bristol, not some sort of alien planet that is put on what was Arena Island. But this is part of a bigger dirty deal. This is being done in order to help YTL develop their site out at Filton. It was a deal where there was an exchange of letters between the regional chairman of YTL and Marvin the mayor, saying, could you please put Temple Island out of reach as from any arena developer so that we can develop our arena at Filton. It was a very dirty deal. There's no other word for it. And somehow, as in desperation to get this through before the election, Marvin has pushed it as hard as he can and resulted in them being able to get have him over a barrel because of he's stuck on timescale.
I mean, if he gets re-elected, is what you're suggesting, this will probably get built then?
Well, if he gets re-elected, it'll get built. But I think it doesn't do his reputation or the reputation of the city or the character of the city or the mental health of the people who are going to live and work there any good at all. This is absolutely alien to this city, which is a city that was built out of many villages. It's got huge character because of that. It's, it's a lovely city, basically, that we tried to wreck in the 60s with highways and high buildings. And we seem to have gone back to that, which I find really odd. And I think most people, the amount of people who stop me in the street and say, what is happening? Why have we never learnt the lessons of the 50s, 60s and 70s when Bristol was being turned into this sort of architectural vision that had absolutely nothing to do with real life?
Well, I think we ought to hear from Mayor Marvin on the Temple Island project, and he was on the BBC on the Emma Britton show a few weeks ago, and so let's have a listen to see what he has to say about this. I mean, the main beef for me, just as a bystander, as a journalist watching this, is why on earth, and maybe we could start by asking you this, George, before we hear from Marvin. How come Legal & General just got the deal? There's no competitive tendering. Is that normal?
It's not normal. There is a path to doing that if you do it in partnership. It's a way of getting around it. But it's very odd, because if I bought a load of, wanted to buy have a contract to supply toilet rolls to the council, I'd have to go out to three or four tenders to do so. Yet you can have one of the biggest land deals in any city and you seem to not have to tender to anybody.
I mean, what's to stop a civic official actually stitching up a deal which is bad for the city like that?
Well, it seems there's been nothing to stop him.
Let's talk about Legal & General. When you scrapped the city centre arena, your cabinet member for housing, Paul Smith, said Legal & General were, and I quote, not suitable to go into business with because of their pitiful record on affordable housing. Now, it's been reported that there will be 40% affordable housing in these plans, but based on that and based on those concerns, why have you not at least explored other options, other developers? Why straight to Legal & General?
Well, first of all, this shows that if within Cabinet, there's a level of rigour going on as well, right? There's not a uniform view. So one of the arguments just made was that because we have a Labour Party Cabinet, we're running rings around it. Well, that's just self-evidently not true. Paul has been challenging within the Cabinet as well. This is by far and away the best use of that site for the City of Bristol and the taxpayers' money that we are responsible for.
But I asked, why just go direct to Legal & General? Why not go to other companies? Why not make sure you're getting the best company for the job?
Well, this is about getting the best company. First of all, these conversations, L&G were in conversations with the city about this site in 2015. All right. As you go back into the report. Secondly, this is about pace of delivery. So our point is, can we get pace of delivery? Again, not Bristol standing on stagnant sites, not getting anything done in a way in which we're sure to get the best site. If we can get the pace of delivery with L&G already here, but know that it's held up to the rigour of government standards on Green Book valuation, Red Book valuation, the legal test and the financial test, then let's do that. Let's
but another company could have done that.
Well, if we take another 4 or 5 years and get nothing done, increasing costs and lost opportunity to the city. But everything we do is rigorously pored over.
Well, I've never heard Emma Britton be quite so challenging, and I think quite rightly so. I think that shows the extreme situation that we have. There are plenty of other institutions that could have competed with Legal & General, and I hope still will. But it needn't have been one big institution. I don't know what he's talking about. This conversation started with Legal & General in 2015. It certainly wasn't to do with anything that on the arena site, which was the only game in town at that point.
Martin, what do you make of this? Surely, if you're going to sell off some land, if the city council is going to sell off some land, and in fact, they're not actually selling it, they're paying Legal & General to take it away for £32 million, surely there has to be some kind of competition here, doesn't there? An auction of some sort. They can't just say, well, you can have the land, no problem.
Well, I bow to superior knowledge here. I mean, if there's a way round it, they've found it. I think the fundamental problem is this, is that in a four-year term, the Labour Party leadership, whoever they may be, and I don't actually agree with elected mayors, they're trying to preserve things like social services and elderly care and all the rest of it. And they are then pushed, because of the cuts that have been coming, not just in Bristol, across the country, they then push to be entrepreneurial. That is to say, just go along with anything that's coming. Because don't think, just once this is built, just think of all the business rates that will flow back into the coffers. And that's the mentality behind it. They shouldn't do it. It's all wrong. But I don't think there's much point picking deliberately
isn't that a fair point,
you know,
George?
This is a fundamental problem with the way we run things.
George, isn't that a fair point that, you know, Marvin is looking to bring some finance into the city council after the government cuts?
Yeah, I'm all for being entrepreneurial as a city leader. I think that's what one should do. We purchased 100 Temple Street for the city. It's produced two other potential sites. It's added tens of millions to the value of that purchase, which was around 20 million. It's probably produced at least 50 million quid's worth. We bought the Royal Mail site on the other side of Temple Meads. That's now going to the university at a large profit to the city, and also I think will produce something really good in terms of business school and all the things that the university want on their second campus. So there are good things that can come out of that sort of entrepreneurial activity. This is simply the wrong entrepreneurial activity, and we're talking about decades down the line before it pays back to the city. Incidentally, they've done everything they can to try and rubbish what was the arena proposal, which would have eventually paid back to the city. It would not have been a cost on the city in 15 or 20 years' time.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, yeah, of course, there's always fingers crossed. I'm not saying it was an absolute panacea, but I think in terms of the benefits to the local economy, it would have been absolutely huge rather than having it on the edge. But I don't want to bat on about the arena. What we are where we are, we now need to do the best thing for Bristol. And the best thing for Bristol is not just simply making the most money. It is building something that is good for the city. But I don't believe in this making the most money. I don't think it will. I think it's, I think Legal and General have probably swung one over the city.
On to another story. And we haven't had any Prime Minister's questions this week, but there was one from last week I thought would be useful to swing out there. And that is to do with the use of medical cannabis, because most countries around the world now are embracing cannabis as a very useful drug. We're not talking about, you know, smoking weed. We're talking about a drug which can actually help you get better in a far, far cheaper way and more natural way than some of the drugs that are produced. So let's have a listen to that now.
Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thanks to the tireless work of my predecessor, the late, great Paul Flynn, and my honourable friend, the member for Gower, and the families of children with intractable epilepsy, medical cannabis is now legal in the UK. So can the Prime Minister answer calls from the families of very sick children who need medical cannabis when this medicine will actually be available in the NHS? And will he come to Portcullis House with me after this session to meet these families and to personally assure them that he will do all he can to help?
Mr. Speaker, it was this government and my right honourable friend, the Health Secretary, who did legalise medicinal cannabis, and I can undertake that he will certainly be happy to meet your constituents this afternoon.
Oh, that's very nice of Boris. But Martin, the main problem here is that we've got a government decision made to legalise this, and yet the people who need it can't obtain it.
Well, this is a big, big issue. Medical cannabis has to be separated from general drug use, as you say. Although, in actual fact, we really need to confront the basic problem of drug use, not just in medical terms. And that's a really big issue, because the banking sector is propped up by drug cartels. The CIA have been involved in this stuff for years. Remember Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North? He's a hero on the right wing in America, on the right wing here, but he was a big drug dealer. He was basically pardoned by George Bush Sr., but everybody knows what he was doing. And then at the same time, we've got all this kind of humming and hawing about doing basic stuff about legalising medical cannabis.
One side of all of this, of course, is that the big drug companies would suffer. If people are taking some kind of natural remedy like cannabis, then they're not taking something else, some sort of manufactured, patented drug.
The case, if you're going to have a national health service, the case for nationalising the pharmaceutical companies is overwhelming, and it's been pushed by lots of developing countries like Bangladesh, for example, years ago, pushing to be able to produce their own generic drugs. And who blocks that in international trade talks? We do. At the same time, we're blocking legalisation of illegal drugs, because the CIA are using that to fund their death squads in Latin America.
Well, I may be cynical, but I wonder whether it's the pharmaceutical industry is egging us on to block those sorts of things. Anyway, George Ferguson, former mayor of Bristol, what do you make on both on the side of medical cannabis and also decriminalisation of drugs, potentially?
Well, I take a pretty liberal view on it. I think, I take it extremely seriously. I'm not an expert, but my hunch is that we should move towards more decriminalisation, more legalisation than we currently have, certainly. I think the medical case is a no-brainer. I know my children and probably grandchildren have experimented with drugs illegally. And I think it's almost attractive to them that it's illegal. They now lead very clean lives. But
Okay, there's a
yeah, so,
okay.
So can I actually
introduce,
think it,
can I introduce yeah. another little thought here?
Yeah.
And that is that if certain drugs are legal, certain drugs are illegal, and a drug which is not really that harmful, at least on a low level, you know, class B or C drug or whatever, is taken by someone and they suddenly think, well, why is this illegal? Then they're more likely actually to experiment with the harder drugs, aren't they?
Well, that is an issue that, you know, people raise, and there's probably some real truth in that. Whether that is used as an argument or whether it is a whether it's a substantial argument, I really don't know. And I think it's quite a difficult one to determine as to whether people find that if they've been on a soft drug, it's easier to take a harder one. But I think it's undoubtedly true that some of the soft drugs are less harmful than alcohol and smoking.
Martin?
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think the problem is we've been looking at this in terms of a kind of social problem. If you live in Latin America, like in Colombia, where I went to Colombia in 2005 as part of a trade union delegation, everybody, the dogs in the street know that the CIA have been working with the drug cartels in Colombia. Pablo Escobar's son gave an interview in the Colombian press about a year ago saying, well, everybody knows that my father worked for the CIA. Everybody knows that that's what goes on. And at the same time, we're arguing about what's happening about, you know, the reality is that the international drugs trade has become embedded
but these are
within
powerful,
the financial
Martin,
services sector.
These are powerful people. How come it's still illegal?
Well, because the CIA don't make, if you were going to make it legal, then of course it's actually the profit margins on it would go down to virtually nothing. Yeah. You can make an awful lot of money out of things being illegal, but once they're legal, you've got the same profit margin as you get on knocking out beer and fags. And that, and the only real cost there is the tax on it. You know, if there was no tax on beer and fags, it'd be very cheap to produce and to buy.
That would be my main reason for liberalising it,
okay.
I think.
Well, you've got to regulate it.
Absolutely, yeah.
How do you regulate it?
Well, you regulate it, for example, like the British when they controlled Hong Kong, because, of course, heroin was legal in Hong Kong under British rule. They basically set the street price at a level where it wasn't sensible for people to smuggle it, but it was high enough to deter people from using it. And you can see the increasing price of alcohol in Scotland has had very positive effects. Yeah. More people can't afford to get as drunk as they used to.
But my son, who used to take drugs of various types, it takes a much harder line than I do about it and doesn't think they should be liberalised, so it's very interesting.
Well, people rather annoy me because they're the people who used to do it and then they decide that now they're opposed to it. It's like people giving up smoking and suddenly decide nobody else is allowed to do it.
Absolutely, he thinks it causes harm. So I don't deny
that it causes harm. Yeah. Nobody should say that this is all good and wonderful.
No.
The point is that tobacco kills far more people and alcohol kills far more people than heroin. There's no doubt about it. But they're perfectly legal, and of course, alcohol was made illegal in the United States for 9 years. It really set the mafia off, and of course, they're now heavily involved in
making cannabis illegal. Come off the back of that, actually.
Well, cannabis was made illegal because it was poor Mexican people who smoked it. Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, and in New Mexico, it's now legal.
Okay, so thanks to our guests, former Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.